Hello, friends and folks, and welcome back to another episode of Scanline Talks, our sort of assorted variety podcast feed where we talk about whatever the hell we feel like. And today it's live. I'm Six Detmar from Scanline Media.
I'm Jennifer Unkle from Scanline Media.
And we both finished the 2022 remake of the 1994 Square Enix Japan-only JRPG classic Live Alive.
Yep. This remake was done under the HD 2D banner they've been using for stuff like Octopath Traveler and Triangle Strategy, though each one of them have had their own unique developers. This one was developed by Historia, the people who made Caligula Effect 2 last year.
Mm-hmm. And it seems like they have another banger on their hand, though, you know, they started with Live Alive, which I'm told is quite good, so, you know, good head start on that one.
Yeah, I guess the COVID and stuff kind of pushed back their plans for this remake a little bit, so it started around 2019, but it ended up getting a little delayed. But yeah.
You know, lots of stuff to get done. I understand, you know, like, there's... It's interesting because this is one of those games where you can simultaneously say, like, they don't make them like this anymore, and also they literally made it like this, you know, today.
Yeah.
Right? But a lot of the foundational work on the game, obviously, since it's a remake, was done a long time ago, and it feels like choices that would not necessarily be made today. But that's getting way ahead of ourselves.
Indeed.
How about we alternate summaries of chapters? I'll give the overall one real quick because I can keep it pretty simple. Over the course of seven chapters, well, secretly it's actually nine chapters, but the base premise is seven chapters. You are going to different time periods and places and playing mini genre piece JRPGs about the various struggles of heroes over time against various incarnations of the Lord of Dark, Odio.
Mm-hmm.
What leads them to Odio, and each one is different. Obviously, everyone has their own story, and sometimes Odio just sort of pops up at the end like, hey, guess what's up? You know, is not even really the focus at all, but, you know, evil always finds its way in.
Yep. And over all those courses, you kind of find out what caused this evil in the first place, and through the final chapter, you're more or less all banding together to vanquish the evil for good.
Mm-hmm. I just to start with, we both liked this a lot, I think, right?
Yeah, like, I had tried playing the SNES version through an emulator, through translation, a while ago, and I kind of bounced off it just because it wasn't... Part of it just wasn't clicking for me. I had started with the Edo Japan chapter, which is maybe one of the most rough starting points you could take, and I just wasn't vibing with the combat at all, and it wasn't going well. But I'm really glad I revisited it this time, because it is a fantastic game.
Yeah, it's definitely... You definitely started with what I would say is, like, as far as the experience of playing it, the worst chapter.
Mm-hmm.
I still am pretty fond of it for various reasons, but, like, going through it, it was like, all right, well, time to, you know, I'm on my lunch at work, time to boot up, you know, the console again. And for a while now, it's been like, okay, between my two smaller breaks and my one lunch, and then, you know, a little time after work, I can usually get through a chapter a day. I was on Edo Japan for several days in a row.
Yeah, I can't imagine playing that one in spurts, just because, like, I did have a decent time with it, but that was only when I was just willing to give it dedicated time, and I also didn't really participate in its gimmick at all.
I did. I didn't commit all the way, but... I don't know, I guess I would say I role-played a bit. But, yeah, I mean, I guess we could go in order. Since this features your girl, Do you want to start with our description for prehistory, the first?
Yeah, so a woman named Belle ends up escaping from this tribe that's trying to sacrifice her and runs into a different cave where Pogo and his friend, what's the name of that friend that he's constantly with?
Gory?
Yeah, Gory. Where Pogo and Gory are just whiling their days using their nose to hunt for meat for the tribe. Belle ends up eating all of the meat and also gets caught out by the tribe. So Pogo, Gory, and Belle are all exiled into the wilds. They end up making themselves better tools and just going across the wilderness until finally they end up confronting the rival tribe and eventually defeating the dinosaur god Odo.
Yeah, this is probably the most straightforward. Well, several of them are pretty straightforward, but by the fact that this one has not no voice acting, but no, it has vocal acting, but not voice acting, I guess.
Yeah, they just have a bunch of characters doing various grunts to communicate things, and occasionally Pogo will yell out, "Pogo!" But that's about it.
Yeah, it is really fun watching this, like, I wonder how much it stood out at the time, but for me, like, going back, like, playing this, you know, again, like, perhaps, you know, new release, but a lot of its expression is old, it was a really delightful, like, reminder and sort of, like, encapsulation of classic, like, sprite pantomime.
Mm-hmm.
In a way that was really fun, where they're just trying to communicate things, and you know, they make modernization changes, right? This is, as we mentioned, HD 2D. It has some cool effects. They don't try and make sprites do things that they couldn't do in Super Nintendo, right? They're higher definition, but they're not like, oh, and we'll add these fancy effects to sprites to communicate better. It's like, no, that's not a priority. In fact, it's a priority to not do that.
Yeah, like, they did draw all new sprites for each chapter in this game in terms of, like, adding to what was there. And, mm-hmm. of course, you have the various 3D effects that get used when attacks are happening. But when people are, like, agog or losing themselves, you still get the same sort of eyes bulging out of the head thing you would get on the SNES and all that.
Yeah, and so you get a lot of people just, like, pointing or, like, doing little dances to communicate. I don't know, the story, of course, by its very nature is incredibly simple.
Mm-hmm.
in the first, but, I mean, it also helps that, of course, you have, throughout this, you're gonna notice a trend of great voice casts, and Pogo's voice actor is Megumi Ogata.
Yeah.
Not just a great voice actor, but also a personal fave of ours, I would say.
Yeah, and it's great to just hear her reacting to things, or making fart jokes and things like that, just through guttural utterances alone.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think that we'll come back to Pogo as we go on, but I think that, well, when I finished everything, I did end up using him to finish it, and I think that the simplicity of his story really hammers home well both in the beginning and the end.
We'll talk about, yeah, I didn't end up using him in the final chapter, though, I have no doubt I will end up replaying this, and I might, you know, mess with some party configurations when I do that.
Yeah, like, after I had gotten the best ending, I went ahead and tried some of the other ending stuff, so I definitely felt that push to come back and do other things.
Mm-hmm. I will say, though, just on the other thing on the note of the first is a lot of these have, like, specific mechanics, and the one for the first is smelling things, and yeah. It's kind of, it's fine, it's inoffensive, it's not the most interesting mechanic.
It's mostly there to abstract random battles, I think, because, like, you use the smell, and then you run into one of the smell clouds, and that triggers a fight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also, you know, like, occasionally it is used in, like, a story context and stuff, but mostly it's just that.
That's another piece that comes into play later when you're near the end game, basically.
Oh, interesting. There's stuff to do with the smell mechanic in the final chapter?
Yeah, like when you're doing everyone's dungeons.
Huh. As I say, I didn't use Pogo, so.
Oh, okay.
Didn't come up for me. Next chapter is Imperial China, the Successor. Which makes it my summary. So we have the aging master of the Earth and Heart martial art, who's like, listen, I'm not gonna live too much longer. I need to get some disciples and pass on, you know, my martial art. And so he goes around and recruits three. They go back and forth on the names in like Japanese and stuff, because they do a little bit of a Journey to the West thing, but mm-hmm. using the English names, which are mostly the same, you have the bandit girl Lei, you have the question mark boy who likes books Yun. He doesn't really have a, you know, he's not as easy to sum up because they don't get a ton of development.
He's the small fry, basically.
Sure, that's fair. And then you have the you know, orphan who has been a terror on the restaurant business, Hong. And after, you know, recruiting them, you train up the students, and then one of them is the successor, because the other two get killed by Odiwan Lee and his rival school of martial arts. And so the master and his last remaining student go to get revenge and sort of set things right. In the end, the master dies and the lone student remains. I'm gonna guess we both went with Lei because she's cooler than everyone else.
No, I went with so I wasn't aware of how this particular chapter would play out going in, so that's my biggest gripe with this one, because like what determines it is who you train the most, and because he was the weakest one, I ended up training him repeatedly. But the thing that kind of bugs me about the way that reveal goes is that, like, in order to have, like, the best fighter later in the game, you're just supposed to choose one of them and train only them. And, mm-hmm. like, I feel like that goes against how I was feeling this particular Shifu would react to each of these characters. Like, I feel like he would make a good effort to train everyone here.
Yeah, I do think it mechanically lets itself down in that way. You're right. I knew this going in. I'd listened to the Abnormal Mapping podcast they did on Live Alive last year, so I was aware of this mechanic. But I do think it is disappointing that it's like, no, it's about, you know, you have these three disciples and you train them up, but really you just train one and let the other two, you know, collect dust. It's like, okay.
Yeah, really shitty master there.
I will say it doesn't matter. Like, as long as you're able to complete the fight at the end of the chapter, it doesn't matter that much, because in the final chapter, you're going to get enough XP that it'll be fine. But,
yeah.
But yeah, I went with Lei because she's clearly the coolest one. And,
oh, yeah. Like, even back then, they talked about how rare it was to, like, have a martial arts woman depicted in a way that was not, like...
You're trying to talk around their phrasing, where they were like, we decided to cast her against type. That's why she has small breasts.
Yeah. Their phrasing's bad. It should be mentioned here that every one of these campaigns, and specifically the characters around them, were designed by an individual manga artist. Some of whom went on to do some cool things. At least one of them ended up creating a right-wing nationalistic manga that everyone fucking hated.
Well, you know. Can go both ways, can it?
Yeah.
The Successor was, like, I don't know, maybe top three favorite chapters for me. I just really liked, I mean, the last, like, the second half of it, basically, because of how it goes. But the mm-hmm. like, the fight through the temple was just a very effective, like, martial arts movie thing. And also, I just found the mechanics of it very fun. And the characters in The Successor had really fun abilities.
Yeah, especially when, like, you get to the final chamber and Obi-Wan Lee is just like, okay, I have all these people who are willing to fight you. Just approach them when you're ready.
Yeah. It's also fun to sort of watch The Successor, like, even mechanically slowly eclipse the Master. I think that's mm-hmm. pretty cool.
Yeah, like, even when you're training your disciples, it's awesome to, like, use moves against them and see them, like, learn them over time. And mm-hmm. that's something that gets used in another chapter as well, but here it's probably more emotionally impactful.
It was very funny that Lei never learned to deal with, like, the, like, lion's rebuke, because I would just smack her away, and then she'd walk in a range, and I'd smack her away, which is, because, like, I trained her exclusively, so by, like, the last fight, she was fucking strong. If we'd had a normal fight where she had competent AI, I think I would have lost, but... instead
there's a few fights in this game here and there when you just kind of figure out the move to push someone away and you just keep doing it over and over again until they die,
and they're just like, I have a ranged attack but I refuse, I'm gonna be stubborn about this. I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
That might have been how it went for me with the final boss, but we'll get there.
Yeah, I guess we're on to Edo Japan next, The Infiltrator.
Indeed.
So, ninja in training, Oboromaru, is sent to rescue rescue a prisoner of war from Ode Io, who's supposed just to be Oda Nobunaga, who has made a pact with demons to conquer Japan. You end up going through his various generals, one of which has, like, ghost-like powers, another one has the ability to, like, well, he's more or less reanimating humans and using them in creepy ways. And at the third,
I mean, one of them's Musashi, so...
Yeah. Well, Musashi's like a fourth one, because...
Fair.
They end up pulling him out later. And then there's also this succubus-like woman that you fight as well. And, yeah, at the end, you're facing him on the rooftop. The person you rescued turns out to be Sakamoto Ryoma, and the two of you end up defeating Odio as he transforms into a toad demon.
And then Ryoma offers you a job. And if you're me, you're like, dog, listen, I'm glad you enjoyed my help here. This is just a job. I'm going back to work.
Yeah, a fun note about this chapter, the characters were designed by Gosho Aoyama, who is these days known very well for doing Case Closed, or aka, yeah, what's the proper name? I'm blanking on it. Like, Detective Conan?
Case Closed I guess it's Detective Conan, aka, yeah, I'd never remember which is which. It's Detective Conan or Case Closed.
Funny thing is, the text also mentions that he finished his work way up in front of schedule, which tracks for a guy who can just, like, pump out murder mystery after murder mystery for weeks and decades. But yeah, like, I ended up liking this one a fair bit just because I decided I was not going to mess around with the whole kill everyone or kill no one thing. So I had, like, a kill count of 27 by the time I finished it.
Yeah, I think I had a kill count of, like, 70-something. I was, like, I was sort of going for, like, the all kill, but mostly it's, like, I just wanted to, like, really explore the map and do the side bosses, and when given an option to kill someone who wasn't clearly a civilian, I did. It's interesting. This is one of those instances where the game, like, it doesn't moralize too much to you, right? Unlike more modern games about, like, you know, killing versus not killing.
Mm-hmm.
But through the way it presents things, there is a clear, like, line between, like, oh, well, here are the soldiers, and then here are, you know, like, the servant girls and the, like, ministers, and it's different to kill them. And I'm like, okay. It's different to kill the servant girls. They don't really have a choice to be here. The people who are ordering people to their death are still bad guys.
Yep.
Just because they're not holding a sword doesn't mean it's a bad thing to kill them.
And there are places where, like, you can... even though you might not be getting a ton of XP from avoiding everyone, like, there's moments in the game where it just straight up goes, okay, here's your farming location. Like, before you fight the undead immortal person, essentially, you have to defeat his ghosts first before you're able to take him down. And, like, you can just keep walking away and coming back into the area and they'll respawn. And they don't count as kills when you kill them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, I mean, they're already dead, so.
That's true, yeah. And there are some fun twists, too. Like, you can kill the succubus lady early on, and your character initially counts it as a murder, but then, like, when you face her later, he just mentally in his head goes, okay, scratch that. That was a demon. Never mind.
I didn't know that. That's very funny.
Yeah.
I also, like, I had a bit of a misunderstanding, because when you save her, she's like, oh my lord, you saved me, oh wow, let me be your wife, and I'm like, lady, we're not doing this right now, and she's like, oh, you hate me that much? And I picked I changed my mind option, because I thought what I was saying is, like, look, it's not that I hate you, I'm just doing shit right now. But of course, Oboromaru is like, yeah, no, I changed my mind, let's have sex right now. And but I had Ryoma with me, and Ryoma was like, dog, that's a demon. It's like, thank you for saving Oboromaru from himself. I don't take responsibility for his choices in this one.
Yeah, as soon as the room floods with pink mist and doesn't let you leave until you confront her, it's like, oh, okay, I need to kill her then.
Yeah, yeah. And I really like a lot of the mechanical conceit of this one. I think you need a better map, and I think it needs to be a little bit shorter.
Yeah, it is fun, though, when you're, like, going through various... It's fun when you're climbing into the attics and dodging the mice and then running across the rooftops. That stuff is pretty cool, but,
Though there's also your fun, like, puppet party member who you can't do anything with. You can fight, like, one bonus boss with him, but otherwise, like, the castle is littered with things that instantly kill him permanently.
Wait, there's a puppet party member?
What, Jen? Yes. There is. Huh. Did you fight the puppet master guy? You must have.
No, I walked near him and he just ran away and then never came back.
Huh. Okay, well, he didn't do that with me. I had to fight him. And then when you get past him, you go into that room where there's the weird little slit in the wall and the rug, right?
Mm-hmm.
In that room, if you give a couple of coins to the slot, it changes the exits and you enter a room where there's just a lifeless puppet. And if you give it the item you get from beating the boss, it turns into a puppet Oboromaru and fights you, and then you beat him and then he's part of your party. Oh. And he has, like, he has a lot of Oboromaru's skills, but he also has his own unique ones. He starts at level 1, but he levels up pretty fucking fast. The problem with it is the fact that, as I say, the you don't get to do anything real with him. You can fight one bonus boss with him, but after the point you get him, if you walk into the next room, a scripted event kills him. And then also, if he encounters a mouse, he freaks out and dies. If he has a fall, he'll die. If he goes into the water, he'll start to smoke, and if you don't quickly leave, he'll die.
Wow, okay.
So you don't get to do very much with him.
Wow, yeah, I can't believe I missed that entirely. That's kind of wild. Though, there seems like there's a lot of this game that you can just straight up miss in the first playthrough, which is interesting.
Yeah, I learned after the fact that I missed the bonus bosses, or there might just be one, I'm unclear, from Pogo's chapter, the Mammoth King or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Though, reading about it, it doesn't seem like I would have had much fun with that, so...
There's a few bosses here, like even mainland bosses that are kind of misses, but yeah.
Wait, does that mean you didn't get, since you apparently weren't doing the secrets on, did you fight the fish boss?
Fish boss. Was that like in the final chapter or?
No, I'm still talking Infiltrator Edo Japan.
No, I did not.
Okay, there's a giant koi fish boss that you can fight. And there's also a ghost of a different samurai who will give you his sword if you beat him that you can find.
Jeez. Okay. I guess I do need to go back to this game after all.
This is one of the ones that has the most secrets in it. And I this is still at its core a Super Nintendo game, so I felt perfectly willing to look this stuff up to check when I was doing chapters, because Super Nintendo games are not known for, like, super telegraphing secrets. You cannot reasonably discover a lot of these.
Yeah, that's one of the things where, like, I feel good that I eventually waited to play it for real once I had this version, because it has a compass in the corner, and that's very helpful for, like... So, like, even in the first chapter, there's a bit where, in order to progress the scene, you basically have to run out of and back into the same room over and over again. And, like...
Mm-hmm.
The compass makes you aware of when you're supposed to do things like that just because it lights up in a certain direction. But yeah.
It generally does. There's in Near Future, which we'll talk about, there's a part where the compass doesn't tell you what you need to do. And there are times where the game doesn't tell you what you need to do and it's good, right? Because it's like, mm-hmm. Oh, your character feels a bit lost and you wander around and you'll find it. But specifically in Near Future, there's a part where you have to walk in and out of a bathroom like 7 times, and it just doesn't tell you that.
Yeah, I kept going in once thinking, okay, is it done now? But no, he had more things to give me. Okay.
Yeah. But yeah, overall, I mean, Oboromaru has one of the most interesting mechanical tool sets. Whether or not you like him, you definitely want Oboromaru in the final chapter. unless you have some other, if you have a specific run you want to do, but his abilities are just so useful. He's got an ability that can instant kill anyone if you get lucky, and otherwise just does huge damage. He's got big AoEs. He's got a lot of different elements. He's really fucking strong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's pretty good.
But this brings us to the most, episode of a TV show chapter, Wild West the Wanderer. We are introduced to the Sundown Kid, or just Sundown for short, or just Kid for short sometimes, who is a... I'll go ahead and cut to the end of the chapter's explanation, where he is a former lawman who basically ended up causing trouble for the town he was in because he was such a... Like, he became infamous as the best, gunman of any lawman, so mm-hmm. people started coming to his town just to cause trouble so they could try him. And in penance for this, he put out a bounty on himself and then just sort of walked off into the desert. Then he stumbles upon, while constantly being chased and hounded by bounty hunter Mad Dog, and constantly sparing him because he's not actually a bad person, he stumbles upon a town that is being harassed by a gang of bandits, and he does the Seven Samurai thing. And he and Mad Dog team up to save it. At the end, the leader of the gang is Odio, who is a person from, like, a soldier from the Battle of Wounded, or no, from Little Bighorn, excuse me. And there's a ridiculous thing and just a great thing about it. This is one moment where, like, every time I saw the dialogue from Odio in this,
mm-hmm.
the localization is just incredible, because his lines in Japanese are fine, but it is just typical anime villain lines. But he is being this sort of like southern poet in this, where he's talking about, like, our mutual currency of violence, and we're dirt men, but we are men the same, and, you know, we have our debts to pay. And he just, the way he talks is really cool.
Overall, there's been some pretty good localization choices here. Like, there's occasionally you'll just hear a character laugh and they'll actually have something to say in the English text or something.
Mm-hmm. And then he turns into a horse.
Yep. It turns out that he was, like, the only survivor in some intense battle, and they just talked about this demon horse that came out of it.
Yeah. They never said the only survivor of this battle was a person. And I was like, okay, because I'd just done Edo Japan. And so I was like, okay, so now I'm going to have to fight a horse demon? The horse just rides off. And then Mad Dog tracks him down and is like, you're my new horse.
This is another chapter with some fun voice stuff. Because, like, they just know who to cast for, like, top tier villains here, like, or just mm-hmm. top tier characters in general. Because, like, for Edo Japan, they had Norio Wakamoto playing Fake Nobunaga, and for this one, they have Akio Otsuka playing the kid, also known as playing Solid Snake in Metal Gear Solid.
And so we could name several roles. He plays Bato in Ghost in the Shell. He's had a pretty storied career, as have a lot of these people. But, like, skipping a bit to the end, like, I quietly pop off in the final chapter when you try to recruit him. The way you do it is you sort of chase him around and keep trying to talk to him, and he just keeps sighing and walking away. And every time, like, Otsuka's delivery of just the, like, and then he leaves is just really, like, this man is very tired.
Yeah. Yeah, and eventually you run into him one last time, and then coming out of the castle, he ambushes you, being like, hey, you gonna keep following me or what?
Yeah. I think, like, I know that, like, some friends of ours, like, Jackson and I think M as well, this is their favorite chapter, and I get why. It's really cool both to have a JRPG that's a Western. And before anyone asks me, yes, I have played Wild Arms. It's fine. But also just, I don't know, like, the tone and the succinctness of this, right? Like, this is one of the ones that doesn't have any random battles. The only fights that happen are, like, the duels you do. And if you do the sort of the mini game that's core to this well enough, the final boss fight, and that's it.
Yeah, basically. And the lead up to that is pretty cool, too, because, like, you're basically doing the classic RPG thing where you're going into every single house and building and looking for materials, but you're doing it in order to equip the townspeople before the time runs out. So you're basically finding all these items, and when you're coming to equip them, Mad Dog will make some comment like, oh, this... women are best with frying pans, so you give her the frying pan, or you give this other person a big pile of horse shit, and they all figure out things to do with them.
My favorite one is the you get from the the bartender, you can get his, like, his sexy poster, his like, his pinup poster. And if you use that as part of the set, you have, like, it's at one of the other traps takes, like, three guys out. And then one of them, like, who flew off screen, crawls in, and he lifts his head, and he sees the poster, and he's like, why is this here? Who would do this? And then he dies.
Yeah. And there's certain items, too, that you can grab if certain people are away doing things. Like, if you basically give the woman that runs the bar, or at least is one of the big members of the bar, something.
Jennifer, to... uncle.
Yeah. The matron.
Finish your sentence.
Okay. If you give her an item to use, you can go into her room and grab her diary.
Oh, it's her diary. Okay. It was not clear from her reaction. I thought you were stealing her underwear. Okay.
No, you're stealing her diary. Like, and you can use it as armor.
Okay. I guess that's a little more acceptable.
Yeah.
Because I didn't do this. She told me to leave it alone, so I did, because I'm a good person.
Something else I wish I had known that you could do or not do is after you defeat the boss, like, Mad Dog challenges you to one last duel, and apparently you can totally just hit flee and leave him alive, but...
Oh, yeah, so you didn't see the thing about him taking Odio as his new steed, because you killed him.
Yeah, I just shot him dead.
Okay, yeah, no, he comes back with Odio, he's riding Odio, and he's like, this is my new horse, Odio, let's do it, let's settle this, and once again, you shoot right past the horse's ear, and the horse panics and throws him off and rides away, and you're like, all right, bye.
that's good.
All right, that makes the next one yours, present day.
Yep. Masaru Takahara lives in a empty apartment with only exercise equipment and is determined to become the strongest fighter out there. His whole thing is that he goes against these various world warriors and sees how they fight by basically goading them into certain attacks and then takes their attacks as his own and defeats them. There's around 5 or 6 people you fight. And once you defeat all of them, a man named Odio Bright ends up approaching you and is like, okay, all those people you killed, all those people you fought, you're weak sauce. I killed them. That means my victory over them was absolute, and you're just a little pretender. So now I'm gonna kill you too. And through the fury of seeing how this person has just straight up murdered all these fighters, you end up defeating him, only to realize after you defeat him that someone else is immediately coming for you as well, and you have consigned yourself to a life of just fighting the next challenger over and over.
Though Masaru doesn't seem too upset about that.
Yeah,
as long as they're not murdering people. He's like, alright, sure.
Yeah. Another great voice cast here, because, like, they got Banjo Ginga to play the Odio Bright here.
I wonder if the name O'Bright is, like, seems more scary to someone from Japan, because...
Yeah, it was just... To me, it's just like, oh, okay, so he's Irish, got it.
Exactly. It's just like, alright...
Also, it's a good time to also mention in terms of voice acting that Tomokazu Sugita is a super fan of these games, of this particular game, and when he heard that they were casting for Live Alive, he more or less petitioned himself to be in the game however possible. So he has a voice role in pretty much all of the chapters here, and for this one he played the Hawaiian Jackie, and it's great to just hear him go, Aloha! When he's doing that Aloha spin.
Yeah, sometimes his roles are quite minor, but it's fun that he's just here in everything. This was my favorite chapter.
Huh, okay. I didn't enjoy it as much as the others just because there wasn't as much for me to grasp on, but I did love the element of it, like, so Yoko Shimomura, very talented composer, and like this was the first game she scored after leaving Capcom and going to Square. And like she's just straight up doing a riff on Street Fighter and all these various stages here. From the select the fighter music to all of that.
Yeah, I mean I think there's, to me, it's the combination of, I really enjoyed, you know, like just the riff on Street Fighter 2. It's really fun. But also just, I really enjoyed the purity of this one just being like really designed boss fights and the mechanics of trying to get them to like trying to bait people to use their moves on you. Because like over the course of this, Masaru doesn't level up at all. If when you pick him in the final chapter, he's level 2. Because it is all just about what moves you learn and putting them to use. And that means that the fights are all like really well designed and there's like a lot of mechanical intentionality. And so but the theming and the aesthetic, but also just the fight design was so much more fun than a lot of the other chapters. Not that it was bad in other chapters, but it's just like every fight is really considered and you trying to figure out like, okay, how would I bait a military like grappler style into using his secret move? Let me see.
Yeah,
I just found it really, really fun.
Yeah, it's the one that leans on strategy the most, to be sure. And it might also be the one where I got the most game overs in just because I was trying to figure out how to fight them. But yeah, that was pretty fun. It also was the chapter that made me laugh out loud because the great Aja has something of a potty mouth. And there's a few times where the game will just straight up start using bleeps.
What is it? Let me find it because I tweeted it out because between his potty mouth and his like skull wrestling mask, I was like, oh, this is just friend of ours fucking crass pants. here it is. when you first start the encounter with him, his introduction line is, "Well, if it isn't the motherfucker himself, Masaru Takahara," and you're like, okay,
yeah, it's pretty good. And you get a fake Hulk Hogan, you get the classic Japanese master that you fight, you get the Russian soldier, and you get a Indian fighter as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's just a, I don't know, I think it's a very, like, there is no filler in this chapter. It's all killer, no filler, and I just think it's really fun to play, and I enjoyed the theming of it, so it is my favorite chapter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could totally see that.
But this brings us to the near future, The Outsider. Akira Tadakoro is the child of a police detective who gets killed young in his life. He has to look out for his little sister, but also he has to struggle with his burgeoning psychic powers. How are you supposed to be a rebel against society when you can always feel what everyone's thinking? He also has to deal with the biker gang, the Crusaders, who are kidnapping people for mysterious reasons. He joins up with his like older friend slash like sometimes like older brother pseudo dad Matsu, who is a biker who runs a taiyaki stand together. So he's with his like pseudo older brother pseudo dad Matsu, And they are going to stop the Crusaders as they end up, like, basically they figure out the Crusaders are helping the government build an idol of, listen, they had a new idea, right? What if we turned everyone into soup, and that everyone was just one bowl of soup and there were no more fights, and we're going to pour that soup into a big old statue of a bird monster?
Yep, and the only thing that can stop them is the Steel Titan, which has to be controlled using psychic powers.
Yeah. This one... What did you make of this chapter?
So, there are parts of it that are kind of incredible to me. Like, from the intro, where you're just staring at a pair of pixelated eyes just blown up in the dark. It's mm-hmm. very striking. It's the thing where you can just read anyone's mind is kind of funny. The whole sequence for, like, trying to get the robot started using your psychic powers is very funny. Like, where you're just running up and down the stairs, touching items, reading books, and then sitting on a toilet, which turns out to be, like, the cockpit. And, or, like, an elevator to the cockpit. But, yeah, it's... Mm-hmm. There's some really fun elements to this. And also... The theme song is done by a singer you might know from Chala Head Chala from Dragon Ball Z, which is fucking wild. He recorded versions both in Japanese and English. Like, that's him both times.
The Gogo Briki Dayo is fucking sick. It's really good.
Yeah. But this chapter is also maybe the most frustrating. Like, there's a particular fight that is straight up fucking unfair until you learn the specific way to cheese it. And, like, I found fighting as Akira and Matsu to be not very fun at all. When you're in the Steel Titan itself, it's a little bit more fun, but, yeah, overall, I'm kind of conflicted on this one because there's some really cool things and some great jokes combined with some mechanics that I really don't like.
Yeah. I know the fight you mean, and I didn't end up using the trick. I just beat it normal. It was annoying. I had to try a couple times. I think most of, like... Akira's powers, his psychic powers, are actually, like, really good at, like, wave clear and stuff. Like, a lot of the fights are not super hard, but when something is at all resistant to your psychic powers, suddenly the fights are just a grind and obnoxious.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not ideal. Yeah, I still think the Edo Japan is more rough than this, but certainly I think they're in conversation. So,
yeah, I'm also not a huge fan of the way that, like, in order to make another, in order to make the character the next route stronger for the final fight, you have to do certain things in this specific route to make it happen, and that seems like such a silly choice to me. But also, like, clearly something you could invest time in if you want to come back to it.
I don't think that you actually have to do that, though. We'll talk about it in a minute, but you're talking about, like, how you have to, like, remove equipment from your turtle robot. By the way, your sister's turtle is about to die, so a mad scientist turns it into goo and pours it into a turtle mecha. That happens, and then the turtle mecha just follows you around and shouts, "Kame!" as it punches stuff.
Yeah. I meant more in terms of, like, there's the mechanic where you take items to the professor to create new items, and some of those can be, like, equipped later.
Oh, but there's so much better equipment in the final chapter. Who cares?
That is, like, true, yeah.
Like, even, like, you're talking about, like, if you talk about, like, the taser and stuff, you can get that from random drops from fights in the final chapter.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that might be my source of confusion then.
Yeah, so it's not actually that bad. I think it might be something that they changed, like, that feels like something they might have changed for this re-release. I don't know that, but I can definitely imagine them being like, let's also make sure that if you didn't do this weird thing that doesn't make any sense in an unrelated chapter, there's still a way to... to get this. So,
yeah. The final proper chapter we have before the game takes its big turn is The Distant Future of the Mechanical Heart. Robot named Cube ends up waking up on the cargo ship Cogito Ergo Sum. Basically, he's been given life and an awareness by his friendly inventor friend, and essentially you go around learning the layout of the ship and meeting everyone aboard. You soon find out that you're basically transporting a monster for the military. Very Final Fantasy-esque looking monster. And as it turns out, the computer on this particular ship, the OD-10, it's deciding to have a hell moment of sorts, or even like a mother moment from Alien. So it's more or less contriving various ways to kill off the crew and unleash this monster to stalk the hallways. So you spend a lot of your time in this, like, in the slow build-up, just going from place to place, learning more, and by the time the monster is loose, you're quickly sprinting between hallways, using your limited-use crowbar to open up certain doors, and eventually find a way to confront OD-10 on his own turf and defeat him.
It's kind of essential, I think, for this chapter that you're playing as this, like, freshly, like, activated robot. Because if you were playing as any human being, you'd be like, guys, it's super obviously the computer. What is wrong with y'all? Obviously, the captain's been dead this whole time. The first time he interacted, it was weird. How are you not picking up on this?
Yeah, like, it's going through some very obvious, it's going through some very obvious motions, but those motions can be pretty satisfying. Like, the bit where, like, it's incredibly creepy the one time that one sort of jock dude ends up dying, and then the corpse is taken by his lover and is put into her bed, more or less. And she's just acting like everything will be fine as the computer tries to convince her to space herself out of an airlock, basically. Like, there's some cool stuff happening here, and it feels like a lot of what's happening in this chapter went on to, like, inspire how specific RPG Maker games in the future would, like, use that format to tell a horror story of sorts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of this game is, like, it's very funny thinking about RPG Maker and how RPG Maker is used these days to make games that are, like, not RPGs, right? That are trying their best not to be RPGs, because it all comes from here. And I don't know how much of that is people who played this game that was a Japan-only game, right? Like, a lot of those RPG Maker games are from Japan, of course, right? But there are also plenty of Western developers using RPG Maker to make not RPGs who probably never knew about Live Alive, and it's like they're inspired by other games doing this, so they don't know the original, or they're just like, hey, this is the tool I have, apparently it can do this, you know?
Yeah, like, this game, even though it did not sell well in Japan at all, did become beloved over time. Like, everyone involved with this remake were kind of taken aback that they got a chance to do it in the first place. So I do think it's a situation where, since the RPG Maker community sort of started in Japan and kind of pushed its way out, I have to imagine people playing games like IB and various other horror games that came from there, Corpse Party, etc. Like, those were all very influential in creating the very vast and broad arrangement of, like, top-down horror games we're seeing today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so in that way, like, Mechanical Heart is, like, it's not my favorite chapter. honestly, it's not even top three for me, but it's so, like, it feels really important for, like, the history of games, honestly. And also, it's just, you know, charming and fairly fun. I like that you only do combat once, and it is it like a virtual reality fight against the AI.
Yeah, and I love the bit where you're finally facing it, and basically through the arcade terminal, and it just takes up the whole screen with text that slowly types out, "Die, child, die." That's some fucking mood, yeah. Right as,
I don't know about mood, Jen. I don't know. I don't know if we need to talk to you about not murdering children, but it is.
I mean, it's good at setting the stage of, all right, we have to fucking fight this thing because it is a menacing force, and megalomania starts up in the background. It's like, let's fucking go.
Yeah. Yeah. It is very good.
Yeah. Megalomania, like one of the best, like, battle songs ever made, I'd say.
It's very good. Every time it kicks in, it's a good time. I started to, like, in the final chapter, I was like, I mean, I know this isn't the final boss, but you could probably play Megalomania here. I wouldn't mind. And they didn't. And then we have, after you do all of these chapters, an eighth chapter unlocks. The Middle Ages, the Lord of Dark. Playing as a knight Oersted, who is he beats his friend to win sort of like the you know, chosen warrior, like, swordsmanship contest in front of the king, and the king is like, great, you're our chosen hero, here, take my daughter, please. And the daughter, Princess Alethea, is like, oh man, you're so strong, I guess that means I love you, I guess that's how this works, okay.
And it's probably kidnapped on a rooftop.
Yeah, immediately kidnapped, like, seconds after saying that. It is also just because of the nature of these chapters, they are somewhat speedrunning narratives at times, but also, I think it works to the advantage of the story they're telling this chapter that everything happens so fast.
Mm-hmm.
So you're like, ah, shit, I guess I gotta go rescue her. And the king's like, you do that? Oh, man, I knew my new son-in-law. I knew you. I picked you for a reason. Go, do the right thing. And then your friend who you beat in the tournament, Strabo, is like, I mean, you're not gonna do this alone. Let me come with you. And you recruit the hero who, and one of his friends who last defeated the demon lord. The hero is really like being a hermit and is fucking done with people. But his friend manages to convince him for one last time. And you go there and you fight the demon lord, and that was not the demon lord. That was just a minion. And then the hero from last time, Hasu, is like, collapses and just pouring blood, and is like, well, I'll be honest with you, I was actually like on death's door, but then my friend called me a coward and I couldn't let that stand, so I decided to go die. And you're like, oh, great. And so you're like, well, shit, we gotta run away. We'll figure out what to do once we're back home. On your way out, Strabo gets crushed by falling rocks. And then you get back to the castle. You sleep on it. You're woken up in the middle of the night because, oh my god, the demon lord's here. It's the Lord of the Dark. He's right in the middle of the throne room, so you kill him, but it was an illusion. It was actually the king. You killed the king. So you're exiled. And Uranus, the friend of the hero, is captured and tortured because they think that you're the real demon lord. And you come back, you get captured. He gives his life to get you out. In order to go prove your you know, innocence, you go to once more to try and rescue the princess. And Strabo's there, and he's like, ha ha ha, this is all exactly as planned, ha ha ha, I'm the demon lord, sort of, kind of, I'm just kind of an asshole, really. Not like a true demon lord, just like a really, really shitty guy. Ha ha! So you kill him, and then the princess sees it, and she's like, I can't believe you'd kill him. He didn't do anything wrong. And you're like, lady, he did so much wrong. And then she kills herself before you can finish your sentence. And at this point, Orested's like, well, I guess I have to go evil now.
No, I think that this is... I'm glad that they leave this one to the end, not just because it reveals, like, who you're actually fighting throughout all of this, but because it has some of the best writing in this specific game. Like,
yeah?
Yeah, like, they get into some real good old English bullshit in terms of, like, the phrasing. I love Uranus as a character who's just constantly upset and obsessed over how the people treated his friend and how... he's doing his best to, like, keep everyone's hopes up when they don't get what they want, or, like, they're spurned when they're not being sociable or doing exactly the right thing. And it's fun to just revisit places, as Orsted also, like, when you're initially going through and everyone's like, oh, you're just this amazing fighter, here, take all this stuff, and... you come back to that village later after you kill the king, and everyone's just screaming about what a monster you are and stay away from my child and all that sort of stuff. And also, I feel like I have a slightly different interpretation of the stuff that happens at the end than you do, in terms of, like, I'm pretty sure that the princess was in on it along with Strabo in terms of, like, her kidnapping and stuff. And specifically... Orsted is kind of a gigantic piece of shit in this chapter.
Like, well, we know she's not in on it, because every time you get a game over, she's like, oh god, the demon, like, we cut to her, and she is freaking out that the demon lord is here. So she clearly doesn't know what's going on.
I guess. I just, the way that it does the little flashbacks after both Strabo and she confronts you... like, you read it entirely differently when she says, oh, your words and deeds have been passed along to me in the past. And Strabo goes into this whole thing like, you've always been a piece of shit. You've always pushed me away, put me in the side. Like, you've always done these things to me. And I've always tried to be there for you, but you're always just there being like, oh, I'm the fucking hero. I get to have everything. And... I just took it as a situation where you're dealing with someone who has just had his life handed to him on a silver platter again and again, and Strabo's kind of broken by that, and when he loses the woman that he and the woman herself, both of them already loved each other, like, they concocted this plan after you still didn't basically let him have what he wanted, and, in order to basically be together and leave you behind.
I mean, I think you're right that he was saying bad shit to her before, you know, you two got betrothed. I personally don't buy that she's in on the whole scheme. Again, partially because of what happens if you die early, the ending you get. And I don't know, it's complicated with Strabo and Orsted, because we certainly do see that Orsted is a character who, you know, has, like, hero's luck, right? Like, things just kind of go his way. And Strabo does have a good point when he's like, and when time came to save the princess, you were like, let me go recruit someone who's done it before, and I'll be along for the ride. Because you are definitely just leaning on Hase there. But also, Strabo is an incredibly unreliable narrator. And we haven't seen Orsted actually do anything selfish. He's been really lucky, but every time someone has asked him to do something, like, he volunteers to go on this campaign, he doesn't ask to marry the princess, she's just handed to him. He doesn't actually take any negative action.
Okay. Yeah, I guess I just read into the flashbacks too much as they were happening, because, like, I read it as a situation where... I was supposed to take a double meaning from some of the things characters were saying earlier.
I think you were. I just, again, I do think she was being like, oh, great, this fucking guy, because of what Strabo had probably been saying to her beforehand. But I just don't think it's to the point where she's like, let's destroy the entire kingdom to spite him. I think that was Strabo.
Yeah.
Let's murder my dad, who I clearly care a lot about. I don't think she was in on that.
Oh, I guess there's also that bit where he mentions that at least part of his plan was concocted when they were in that chamber. Like, he noticed the door at the bottom and used that as an opportunity to be like, okay, I'm just gonna make this happen.
And incredibly, like, listen, it's Erstad. He's playing, you know, the, like, the Warrior of Light, right? He's playing that classic role. And so he has to be a little thick. And so I'm not saying this is a problem with the story, but as a player, when the wall shakes and you just hear Strabo go, oh God, I'm dying. You're like, Strabo, you're clearly fine.
I do like how Orsta doesn't say a single thing until like the very end of this chapter, like no lines whatsoever. And then when he decides, okay, fuck all this, he starts to speak up and basically takes the reins as Odium. And you get a little hint that that's where it's going when you first get to that area, and suddenly you're seeing statues all around the various bosses you fought throughout the game.
But, like, at that point, it, you know, I mean, I kind of am having to pretend the experience of someone who didn't know, because, as I say, I listened to the podcast about it. I know how this goes. But, like, at that point, you can easily believe, like, and look, these are the various incarnations of the Demon Lord over time, or whatever, right? Like, it still doesn't necessarily break the illusion that you could be about to face the evil that caused all this. And it's like, maybe the end of the chapter is that Orsted wasn't quite able to do it, and he needs your help or something. And then also, you have the moment where you're like, okay, so maybe the problem is Strabo. And I mean, the problem is Strabo. Strabo is the cause of everything bad that happens in this game. But Erstad does sort of take a little inspiration. I also like that, as you say, he doesn't talk until the very end, which it's not just that, like, it is the moment at the end. It's the moment where he stops being the classic JRPG protagonist, right? Where he falters in that role. As long as he is serving as JRPG main character, he cannot speak. Mm-hmm. The moment where he gives up that mindset is when he gains a voice.
Yeah. And that all leads into Dominion of Hate, where you get to choose the protagonist. You can choose any of the seven heroes, or you can choose Orsted and see what happens.
Look around and find out.
Yeah, like, Orsted is... That's a very funny alternate ending to have, because essentially what you're doing is you're going to each of the statues and you're like, I'm gonna do this better than they did. And you replay all of the various boss fights, except you're in the boss role. And, each boss, like, once you're making the decisions, not the AI, you could just wipe these heroes out in no time. Though, if you do let your health get to a certain point, Flea gets replaced with Armageddon, and you can just hit that to just blow everything up, say fuck this.
Yeah, because if you successfully beat them all, you get sort of an ending where it's like, yay, I killed everyone, I get to live alone in an empty world. But if you have to hit Armageddon, then you don't get that. You just destroy everything, including yourself.
Yep. But if you choose one of the other heroes, you basically get pulled into this timeline, and you go around recruiting all the other characters. Or as many as you want, really. Like, I think you can push it forward if you just recruit three or four of them.
I think you have to recruit three for a total party of four in order to get in. But, yeah.
Yeah, this is also where they have some of the most fun, like, with the various RPG mechanics, since at this point, it's just straight up like, okay, we're going to have random battles when you're stepping X number of steps and all that sort of stuff. And they just introduce fun ideas. Like, there's a particular... each character has their own trial dungeon, where you get their ultimate weapon or a similar thing to that. And, like, you have certain fun ones where, like, okay, the Cowboys one, Sundown Kid, it's just a wide open mazy area, except every 10 seconds it gets darker. And if you manage to, if you're still in there by the time it goes completely pitch black, you have to fight a secret boss. Or there's another one where, like, if you just keep hitting flee, by the 95th time, the game's gonna call you a fucking coward. And by the 100th time, you have to fight another boss.
That's not a trial-specific thing. That's just specific to this chapter.
Yeah.
But, yeah. So who was your, like, your canon party? Who's your crew for this?
Okay. So first I went with Pogo. Just because, like, I thought it'd be fun to have someone calling the shots who can only really answer questions and grunts. And just looks at signs and is like, I don't know, making a ha ha noise. I went.
Can I get that noise again?
Ha ha.
Oh, okay, great. Thank you for clarifying.
I went with Cube because Cube has healing abilities, and you can kind of just. Cube is the only character that you can't level up, but you can kind of just equip new items to him to make certain attacks and his armor better and all that. Still, maybe the weakest character in the game, but. That's something.
I mean, you can upgrade him with the upgrade parts, right?
Yeah.
Those upgrade his stats, I think. So.
Yeah. Stats, not level, but yeah. You can bring in the Sun... I brought in the Sundown Kid because he's a good ranged attacker. And, like, once you have his ultimate, like, level 15 ability, it's... The damage is listed as light to medium, but, like, he shoots a total of 6 times, and that can kind of just... fuck people up severely.
And yeah, it maxes out the damage counter. You can hit 999 pretty easily.
Yeah. And finally, I had a Boromaru, just because he had some real good both ranged and up close attacks.
Okay. So our third and fourth party members we had in common. My third was a Boromaru, and my fourth was Sundown. I started with the Earth and Heart Master Lei. I took a very different approach of not like what would be funny. I was like, who would be a good leader? Not to make you feel embarrassed about your choices, Jennifer, but.
Well, I think my choices ended up being thematically powerful at the end.
Yeah,
anyway,
I'm just teasing. but, and then my other one, I also had, Masaru. His abilities were kind of shit, frankly. Masaru is not very well suited for this chapter. It ended up being fine because of the power of other characters. But I really, like, I mostly picked Masaru for the moment where, as Lei, I walked into the area where Masaru is being kept, and he's like, oh, have you come to challenge the strongest? And I beat him in one hit. I was like, yes, I have, chump.
Yeah. A nice thing about Pogo is, like, his level 15 is just this incredible... Level 16 is this incredible 7-hit attack that just fucking whams people. Like, he does take a number of debuffs after doing it, but you can... If you basically condition him right, you can take out various body parts of the final boss in, like, 2 to 3 turns.
Yeah, definitely. I knew I was passing on Pogo because I passed on Pogo mostly because I wanted, like, dialogue and interactions, and I just felt like tonally he wouldn't fit as well. But I'm sure I'll do it again, and I do love Pogo. Pogo's great.
Yeah. Also, like, the fun thing is whoever you choose ends up getting unique dialogue when you confront Odio, and he's basically. Testing the... He's more or less weighing each one of your souls by challenging you for why you do things. Mm-hmm. And in terms of Pogo, it's just like, So you did all this because you like that one woman, huh? You're just really in love with her. And he just goes, love! And he's like, okay, okay.
it's really good because with, I don't know, I assume it's mostly the whoever's the main character is the one who ends up talking back, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because everyone else is sort of like, you got a point there. When he turns to Lei and he's like, so you did this because you wanted to, like, to uphold the, you know, what's the fucking word I want?
The earthen heart style?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like the goals and like, stuff of your master. And she's like, yeah, so fucking what? You got something to say about it? And she's, like, not interested in his shit at all.
Yeah.
And then she won the game for me because, certain choices were made. I thought there were going to be more forms than there were. So I was hoarding healing items. And then in this final fight, Odio does some shit where he loves to knock people out with one hit and then drop a damage tile on them. So as soon as their turn again, they instantly die. So by the time I was fighting the second form of Odio, it was just Lei left. Everyone else was dead. And okay. Lei just soloed him. It was not a problem.
Jeez. Okay. Yeah, like, the key for that fight, at least for me, is, like, it's manageable. You just have to be good on healing. And also, like, you need to make sure that you do not wake up the eyebrows. Like, mm-hmm. you attack everything else except for the eyebrows until the end. In which case, okay, you can take that at the last thing now. Yeah, like, you get those two forms, and then you get a bit where you run out into the field, and you go through, like, the boss rush. Each character fights their boss again, except this time they're massively overpowered compared to where they were before, so you can just wipe the floor with them. And then the game pulls out one last surprise for people who are, like, have played the original. And you fight a final form of Odio.
You only do this if you recruited everyone.
Oh, okay.
Had to watch it on YouTube, but because the stuff I saw didn't say this. They just said, and then you'll fight this. And I was like, why the fuck didn't I see this? So I had to look it up.
The recruitment stuff is initially confusing because it makes you think that you're de-recruiting people when you grab someone else for the party, but in actuality, you're just, like, the game still counts them as recruited. But that fight is so fucking cool because, like, you're breaking off various body parts, and then Odio pulls out moves to, like, bring the other half in, and each one has to do their own fights, and, by the end, like, when things are getting to a certain point, each one of the characters gets to unleash their own attack all in order, and then Orsted cuts his way out of the guise of Odio and delivers the final blow himself.
Mm-hmm. And then you get a great scene. How did this scene play out with Pogo as your main character?
It was so good. Pogo just walked up to him and hugged him and just shared a small grunt. It was really touching.
That's interesting because the video I watched was someone else who also had the martial arts master, but they had Yun. And Odio and Orsted is there like, man, all this shit went bad and I just had to turn evil. And Yun is like, I think perhaps there was a moment where shit went bad and you could have dealt with it or you could have been a dickhead and you chose to be a dickhead. And Orsted's like, damn, I did shit.
Yeah. And Orsted ends up passing away at the end, but he does leave you with the words that you have to be on your guard because there will always be this temptation to turn to evil, and there always has to be someone to face it.
And then you have a flashback to that the second he stops talking, which is one of the few parts of the game where I'm willing to say is just stupid, of having me have a flashback to something that happened less than a second ago.
Yeah, they could have reworked that part for sure. Yeah, then you get this great credit sequence where you're just watching everyone go to their own times, but also, like, rejoining so they can run off into the sunset together. And then you get back to the main menu, and they change it so the A shows the final form of Orsted. And you, when you're at that title screen, you're just seeing all of the... you're seeing the seven characters stare off into a sunny sky.
Yeah.
It's real fucking good.
That's Live Alive. Yeah. So, did you notice, Jen, when playing the Middle Ages, that you're just playing a more negative version of Stranger in Paradise?
Yeah, there are a number of similarities, huh?
He's trying to be the hero, and everything suddenly goes wrong, and everyone's cursing his name, so he decides to become the Dark Lord.
Yeah, though I guess in Stranger Paradise, they try and make it more sympathetic, because, like, basically Stranger Paradise has, like, some even bigger villains that Jack's like, well, fuck y'all, I'm just gonna take the role of villain in this world so y'all don't get your toys anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel like that's just another example of how Live Alive's sort of influence has echoed down, that there was basically a whole game based on what if Orsted was right.
Yeah. Like, overall, I really, really loved this game. Like, yeah. I can't believe two of the best JRPGs I've played in years, I played in the same year, and they were both from the same company, more or less.
And they were both live 2D. Or 2D, 3D, or what? I forget what it's called.
I wish I had that much love for Triangle Strategy, because, like, it's doing some neat things, but also, like, the story is... Like, okay, you want to have the kingdom, you want to have the religious oligarchy that's handled in a super racist way, or do you want the guy who just is laughing about capitalism the entire time, just being like, oh, I'm going to give them the free market, and then the free market will reign supreme.
Yeah, it has some problems.
Yeah, really good game, but it's just, the story is kind of bad.
Yeah. No, of course, you meant Stranger Paradise, I'm assuming.
I meant Caligula Effect 2, because I played that this year, too.
Oh, okay. Okay. I meant Stranger Paradise. Stranger Paradise is great.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's just... Live Alive is probably going to be our game of the year, is what I'm going to guess. But, you know, there's still 4 months left. I suppose something could happen.
Yeah, there's still stuff to play. It's been funny just how many... I just keep buying Square Enix games this year because they keep making interesting things. Some of them are worse than others, but, like, overall, this might be one of the strongest years they've had in terms of, like, interesting releases.
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely been a banner year for them. And I hope they take the right lessons from this, right? Like, I don't, you know, we're not going to learn sales numbers on this stuff. That's not how this happens. But I hope we see them make these interesting choices again, because they have a tendency to make much more boring choices, I would say.
So. Yeah. Yeah, agreed. And if nothing else, I imagine this ended up doing much better than its SNES counterpart, if only because it's releasing a lot more territories and has a real marketing budget behind it. Though, kind of wish they didn't try and spoil some of the end stuff in the marketing, or even, like, the cover. It's whatever, though.
Yeah.
Back of the box is just straight up, oh, hey, here's the eighth chapter.
Yeah. Though, I almost think that works for me, because you're going to see stuff about it. And I think it is easy, if you don't know fully the twist, to go into the eighth chapter like, oh, and here's this, you know, as I say, like, earlier, like, here's this warrior fighting against the Demon Lord and he doesn't succeed or whatever. Right. Like, I think you could easily misinterpret because of how blatant they're being about it.
Yeah. And also, just like, even if it does kind of just tip its hand a little too much, the new cover they did for the Switch version is very beautiful. Like, mm-hmm. fantastic versions of those characters. I like this version of Pogo way more than the SNES Pogo picture, which looks very weird.
Yeah, I think, like, you know, obviously neither of us played the original, but I think this, like, remake looks like both, like, faithful to the spirit of the art, but, like, really pretty, and the voice acting is really good, and I think this is the version to play.
Yeah, this might be the one where they finally got their HD2D style together, since they've shared some similar producers and stuff like that across all those projects, even different developers, but, like, this game just looks phenomenal, and there's certain moments, like when you're in the intro for the Earthen Heart, and he's in front of that boulder watching the sunrise, and it's like, jeez, they did so much to, like, make this game from 1994 just look absolutely gorgeous today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I guess that's it for Live Alive. Thank you so much for joining us. You should probably play it.
Yeah, but I would definitely recommend it. And if it's anything like Octopath Traveler, it'll be a situation where it's Switch exclusive now, but give it a year or so, and you'll probably have it everywhere else too.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, it's Plug Zone time. Jen, where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me at scanlinemedia.com and patreon.com/scanlinemedia. I'm at JBU3 on Twitter. And I also host a visual novel, well, narrative gaming book club podcast called Novel Not New Age Run Podcast. It is currently on the Abnormal Mapping Network, but by next month we'll be hosting it on Scanline Media. So soon more of my stuff is going to be collated into the same place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You can find me the same places for my work. As far as me personally, it's at SixDetmar, SixDetmar on Twitter. And yeah, take care of yourselves, folks. We'll see you around.
See ya. Can you?